This has been an extremely moving journey. On my notes, it says, don't cry. I will cry. So I'm warning you now, I will probably weep during this event. But that's simply because, firstly, I'm so proud of this, the booklet. And secondly, the actual project itself really took a lot to do it. The idea for Found Voices came last year. I was at home thinking, what can I do that is something for Ledbury that will remain forever in Ledbury, that people can do, that they can use poetry to see things in a different way? And I came up with the idea of writing a poem about 8 heritage buildings in Ledbury. Then I thought, right, this will probably come to fruition in 2018, which is the centenary of the end of the First World War. At that time, I was very interested in something called found poetry. And this is poetry where the poems use lines, words, and phrases from other sources. And they're kind of knitted in, sewn in seamlessly to create a new piece of work. So I wondered, right, is there a chance that I could mix the writing of poems about heritage buildings in Ledbury with words written by First World War poets? So I spoke to Rachel, who works with Joined Up Heritage. I gave her the idea, and she went with it, which is fantastic, and I'll talk more about that later. The project got bigger. We brought in Ledbury Poetry Festival, who then put some money towards the project incorporating the primary school. And so yesterday I took around a groups from Ledbury Primary School, over 60 children, who wrote poems about 6 of the heritage sites. And you'll see in this booklet, towards the back, these QR codes. The idea with this is that you put your mobile phone to these little things, symbols, and on your phone will pop up a film of the children performing their poem that they had written about each place. So the project went beyond me, which is exactly what I wanted. Now, I'm going to read 2 poems in each place. So obviously we're here in the Master's House, and I wanted you all to have a copy of the book so that you can follow me with this. The poems themselves are made up of my words, words that I found within the buildings themselves, and words written by First World War poets. What I did is I assigned one war poet, to each building. I thought that would probably be the easiest way of doing it, except for the Heritage Centre at the old grammar school, where I've used a range of women war poets for that one. I'd like to just begin by reading you the bit in the book that is the poet's perspective. It's probably something that you may not have had time to read right now, but it says everything I want to say about this project, how it started and how I came to write the poems. So if you don't mind, I'm going to read this introduction. Found Voices celebrates Ledbury's heritage and commemorates the centenary of the First World War. In early 2018, I was commissioned to write a series of poems inspired by 8 heritage sites in Ledbury, using words found within the buildings themselves and from First World War poetry. Writing poetry in this way is like creating a collage of words, in the same way a visual artist might use different materials to create a picture or a piece of art. It involves searching for interesting fragments, words, phrases and lines that will fit seamlessly into the flow of each poem. I spent many hours researching local history and absorbing the particular atmosphere of each building, scribbling notes and seeking out fascinating little details and snippets of information to sew into the poems. I decided early on to assign specific war poets to each building, but the final choice of poets came down to chance conversations, my feelings about the character of each building, and fortunate strokes of serendipity. I knew Woodbine Willie was the poet for St. Catherine's Chapel after the Reverend Bill Mackenzie told me he was his favourite poet. Anna Stenning, a guide who showed me around the market house, mentioned she had studied Edward Thomas for her PhD. I linked the Gloucestershire poet and composer Ivor Gurney with the Butcher Row House Museum, primarily because of its amazing collection of musical instruments. Isaac Rosenberg attended the Slade School of Art, and it felt right he should be the poet paired with the 16th century painted room. I wanted to write a sonnet about St. Michael and All Angels Church, and Rupert Brooke was the obvious poet to work with here, as he had written a series of sonnets entitled 1914. The poem for the Heritage Centre at the Old Grammar School contains the voices of women war poets, in part resonating with the untold stories from the children educated there, as well as teaching awareness about the effects of war from a marginalised perspective. Siegfried Sassoon admired the poetry of John Masefield, so it was appropriate to place him in the Master's House, where the library contains an archive display of Masefield's work. Wilfred Owen met Sassoon at Craig Lockhart Hospital in Edinburgh during the war, and I liked the idea that his words would contribute to the poem about the Barrett Browning Memorial Institute, which also once housed the town's library. In my mind, the library was a common thread binding these two poets together, just as Craig Lockhart Hospital was a place they shared when alive. This is probably where I'm going to start crying. It was a profound revelation to explore the work of the war poets for these poems. I dug deep, and it left me feeling upset, angry, frayed, tearful, and haunted, but also enlightened, alongside a barb of sorrow and gratitude that their poems continue to exist with relevance, energy, and strength today. I felt a keen sense of responsibility when I was writing my poems. I was aware I was using their words in a context so unimaginably different to the circumstances in which their poems were originally written. In putting these seemingly unrelated subjects together, heritage buildings and war poetry, I wanted my poems to respect their words, but also be free enough to see what interesting and unexpected results would emerge from this fusion. I am a writer who enjoys puzzles and wordplay, the tricks and intricacies of language. Two of the poems personify the buildings, letting them speak in their own voices. The market house talks about its situation and place in the town's centre landscape. The painted room addresses the reader in flamboyant tones. You may also detect some cunningly placed references. The first word of each line in the Master's House poem reveals a message painted on a beam in the Great Hall. Look carefully at the poem for the Barrett Browning Memorial Institute, and you will find numbers in sequence from 1 to 12 to reflect the clock tower. But keep this thought to the fore. Not all the numbers are spelt in their numerical form. These poems were not written to be a treasure hunt, though you will find many treasures along the wet trail. Rather, they were composed to offer a contemplative companion to information guides and leaflets. I hope you enjoy visiting the sites and discovering how found voices from unusual sources bring attention to Ledbury's heritage buildings in distinctive and surprising ways. So that's where it started. So we'll go to poem number one, which is The Master's House. Now, just to work down through that poem for the benefit of people who don't live in Ledbury and have only just entered this place, the Master's House was built in 1487, and the quote on the beam is in the bottom, in the little sort of plaque bit there. Whoso walketh uprightly shall be saved, but he that is perverse in his ways shall fall at once. And if you see, as I've said, the first word of each line spells that out. I've referenced people, Jim Stafford and Sybil Hall. These were people that actually lived here, worked here, gardener. I spent time in the buildings looking at how amongst this beautiful old building we have modern things like the tablet tours where you can hold a phone and you can hear characters talking. So I wanted to bring this in. There have been over 60 masters, and the master's house has changed over the centuries. So we have a Tudor case, or Tudor shell, a core as it were, encased in a Georgian exterior. But the renovations have kept as much of the original building as possible, hence my reference to the new tracings honour the originals. The library, just here, used to be the kitchen, and you can still see the range, the ovens and the copper for the laundry, and that is where the John Masefield archive is, who was the poet laureate born in Ledbury. A few words about Siegfried Sassoon. If you just look to the back of the book on page 18 are the biographies. Siegfried Sassoon was the poet I chose for the Master's House. He was born in 1866 in Kent. He was educated at Clare College in Cambridge, and he was decorated for bravery during action. He won the Military Cross. But he became increasingly critical and disillusioned of the nature of war. In 1917, while he was convalescing, he made a famous protest about the war to Parliament. He was sent to Craig Lockhart Hospital, where he met Wilfred Owen. Then he went back to active service in November 1917. He was one of the few war poets, the male war poets in this book, who survived the war. So here is my poem, The Master's House, with Siegfried Sassoon. Whoso steps over the threshold into this heritage of heart walketh through a peaceful share of time, deep shadowed, uprightly, unshaken as the steadfast walls. But what game of ghosts shall chase us through the centuries? They are gathering round. Be ready. Masters, servants, gardeners and crafters, characters saved in the padlocked architecture of beams, bricks, glass, breathless but animated still, caught in talking heads and tablet tours. Jim Stafford, he keeps beehives in the orchard. Sybil Hall smells picked lavender. That humankind, proud of nothing more than having good years to spend, is drifting beside us. A palimpsest of phases and patterns, with nothing perverse in design. New tracings honour originals. Tudor shows through in struts and trusses, wattle and daub. Master Cooper kept accounts, his lists of names, trades alive while the world's events have rumbled on. Ways reread as we search for books where kitchen cooks flurried. We shall park our cars on tarmac farmyards, use shiny houses of office, fall behind the times of cockcrow and the candles guttering gold. Dream at the delights praising John Masefield, this little town's most famous son. Once a building at risk, housing our library, culture, Ledbury's home. I should perhaps say that in the poems, the words written by the... Thank you. The words written by Siegfried Sassoon are in a slightly lighter type than the black, and they have obviously been checked, so the numbers correspond with the poems towards the back of the book. The second poem I'm going to read here is the Barrett Browning Memorial Institute. Now, just reading through this poem, I speak about one man with a pull of will. In 1889, William Russell of Woodlands Parkway suggested building a clock tower in Ledbury as a fitting memorial and tribute to the poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Now, the Barretts lived in Hope End, just outside Ledbury, from 1809 until 1831. And so a model was made and erected in the marketplace, level to where the Three Counties bookshop is, literally right in the middle of the high street. And people were not happy about this, as to have a huge, great building right there. So eventually, it was built on the corner of By Street, where it is now. By Street was widened by 8 feet to actually accommodate the building. Now, subscriptions paid for it, including the town's gloveresses, who collected £5 in penny pieces. And it opened on Thursday, the 16th of January, 1896. And it was opened by the author Henry Ryder Haggard, who unlocked the door with a golden key. It is now, it's a building with potential. Ledbury Places, the organisation Ledbury Places, is raising money to renovate it. There is a youth drop-in there that happens twice a week. So the poem that I, the poet I chose to work here with was Wilfred Owen, for reasons mentioned in my introduction. Now, The biography at the back talks of Wilfred Owen. He was born in Oswestry in Shropshire in 1893. He enlisted in 1915. From the age of 19, Owen wanted to be a poet. He particularly immersed himself in Keats and Shelley. He was deeply attached to his mother. There were 664 letters addressed to her, and she saved every one. He went off to war with in good spirits. He wanted to be a soldier. But he soon, the horror of war came as a profound shock to him. He was blown up, he was concussed, and he suffered shell shock. So he was sent to Craig Lockhart War Hospital in Edinburgh, where he met Siegfried Sassoon, who had a huge effect on his poetry, a real inspiration. Owen went back to war, he won the Military Cross, and then on the 4th of November, he was shot and killed. News of his death reached his parents a week later on Armistice Day. Absolutely terrible. His parents actually received the telegram that he had died while the bells were ringing out on Armistice Day to talk about the end of the war, to say the end of the war, announce that. There's a lovely quote, well, not a lovely quote, it's a quote that I got from here, where he writes, "My senses are charred. I don't take the cigarette out of my mouth when I write deceased over the letters." Such a difference from the boy who went to war to what the war actually did to him over the years. So here is the poem, Barrett Browning, Memorial Institute. Watch for the numbers. One man with a pull of will began this building, rising hour by hour, a memorial to Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the poet laureate of Hope End. Reading rooms and libraries warming the course of patient knowledge with open fireplaces, and literature, science, art, three holy glimmers of enlightenment purposed for the people of Ledbury. Subscriptions paid in pounds and penny pieces, brought into being by fellowships and friends, this institute was theirs, is ours, will be yours. A common sense of future, from the high five of the youth drop-in to the upgathered potential in patterns of peeled paint, cracks and cobwebs, relaxed floorboards, specks that in the sunshafts turn to words. Oh, life, life, let me breathe. Let me count the ways I could love this town. It may seem at sixes and sevens, but sidelong ideas flock, pause and renew, circle like swifts around the clock tower, light and clear. What shall we do here? Centre stage, by street widened by 8 feet to accommodate, unlocked with a golden key, deep thinking in silentness of duty, the clock dials face the compass, strike the steady running of hours that fall like ninepins and stand again from golden east to bronze west. This building shows a slow grand age, a well-mannered mix of timber and stone befitting the almshouses, the flourish of the town. Substantial, full again with expectations of quick municipal activity, a principle amongst the ten-a-penny coffee shops. Imagine the view from the top of the tower, the crest of roofs, trees, a last hill, your hands resting on the misty panes behind the 11th hour. Barrett Browning, she knew the meaning of a people's building. The cogs, wheels, mechanisms that invigorate, tick it into civic motion, keep it going, from larger day to huger night, before time's careless, carefree break at 12. I said, imagine standing at the top of the tower. I actually did that. I climbed right to the top and put my hands on the clock face behind, knowing that the whole of Ledbury was living their lives, not knowing I was up there. So that was absolutely wonderful. Right, we move on. We're now going to St. Catherine's Chapel through that green door. Thank you. I have to confess that I actually didn't know, I'd never been in this place until I started doing these poems. And the first time I came in here, I came to a service on Friday morning, And I sat in the corner over there with my my notepad, and I spoke to Bill McKenzie, and I said, is it all right if I sit here and I'm making notes? And he said, yes, absolutely. What are you doing? And I told him about the project, and he said, oh, you must look up Woodbine Willie, my favourite poet. And so I thought, well, that is a given. It will be Woodbine Willie, or, as he's otherwise known, is, let me find him, Geoffrey Anquetil Studart Kennedy, known as Woodbine Willie. So this is St. Catherine's Chapel, part of St. Catherine's Hospital. As you can see from the plaque on the page, it was founded by Hugh Folliot, over there, Bishop of Hereford, for wayfarers and the poor, 1232. The plaque, by the way, is on the front of the building, overlooking the High Street. So all of these little things here are all somewhere in the building. It's a combined chapel at East End, which is what you're in now, with great open hall there for master and brethren beyond. Fine timber roof. I love that the roof was actually referenced as a thing to look at. We can't go into the hall today, but we're coming straight here to the chapel. Basically, this was set up as St. Catherine's Hospital, founded to offer hospitality. The whole community lived in the hall. So you had brethren and the master would all be in the hall, all sleeping, living their lives. The beds being placed around the walls, with a fire in the middle, and this chapel, which at that time was open, so it wasn't partitioned off. The brethren used to choose the master from their own number. Now, the master's house, as we know, was built in 1487, and that's when the master at the time moved there and lived there, and that's when that kind of community, as it were, started to break up, and almshouses and what have you. So people then left that idea of all sleeping together and living together in one space. The chapel here is still in use. It's open on a Friday morning for services, and I believe Wednesdays as well. But as I've said, it's now partitioned off. For this poem, I imagined the congregations that have been here in the past, over hundreds of years. And it felt to me like those congregations are still here. That idea of them coming, not as ghosts, because that wasn't subtle enough. It's just that idea of that congregation being somewhere beyond, but still here. You're sitting in a place where, well, countless people have sat and worshipped. In the poem, I make reference to, in verse 2, I make reference to them being clothed for work. In one of the poems by Woodbine Willie, he talks about how to him, to be dressed in a divine way was to be dressed as a soldier, ragged, bloody, dirty, muddy. This is being clothed in the divine. It's the clothes of work, and it's not in silks, and it's not in lace, and it's not in anything fancy. This is the real stuff of being human and what you have to do in order to be human. So I reference that in the poem. The other reference, which you'll need to know, is that there are tiles on the floor here, which are medieval tiles. And they are the original medieval tiles here on the floor. So you basically walked on them when you came in. It's just incredible. You're actually walking on something that old. And they have pictures there of peacocks, not these ones, just to make you aware of. Thank you, Celia. Yes, these ones are Victorian, but the ones, they're over there and they're over there, okay? And they've got some beautiful pictures on them still, peacocks, sunbursts, petals, flowers, but also they have inscriptions in Latin, which translate as Lord Jesus have mercy, which is something that I've put in this poem. Just to talk briefly about Woodbine Willie. He was born in Leeds in 1883. He was very, very proud of his nickname. The reason why he was called Woodbine Willie was because he gave Woodbine cigarettes and spiritual aid to dead and dying soldiers. He was a chain smoker himself and asthmatic. But what he would do is, and he received the military cross for this, he would crawl out into no man's land on his stomach while everything's going on, to where an injured soldier was, and just be with him, talk with him. And if he could, if it was up to it, he'd give him a cigarette, give him a woodbine. Amazing. In 1914, he became the vicar of St. Paul's in Worcester. And as I said, he won the Military Cross. After the war, he converted to Christian socialism and pacifism, and he went on speaking tours around Britain. In 1929, he became ill on a tour, and he died in Liverpool. When it came to his funeral, mourners placed packets of Woodbine cigarettes on his coffin and his grave. He was known as being the soldier's poet. They felt he spoke in their language, and he very much did. He did not speak in the language of Wilfred Owen or Siegfried Sassoon. His poems are much rougher than that. They speak in the actual language that men talked at that time. So those are the things I want to say about this poem. I think everything else is self-explanatory, and please do feel free just to look around while I'm going through the poem. So, St. Catherine's Hospital, Chapel and Hall. It waits, unassuming, at the side of the road. A place built on faith, hope, charity and thanks, the brethren bricks of worship. No timber pillars or magpie colours, just strong stone, dedicated to God, Blessed Catherine of Alexandria, the saving of souls. Dedicated to pilgrims like us, travelling through life, doing our best to avoid potholes, pitfalls, the obstacles of being human in this world, seeking out rest, warmth, comfort, the helping hand of simple hospitality, the spirit to carry on when the hope of life is gone. The hall catches the eye with its trusses and braces, collar beams and curves, a hymn to early engineering. A common space, once for sleeping and feasting, now buying and selling, coffee mornings and meetings. But change tempo. Open the door to the East Chapel, humble as grit, small as a pearl is small. History settles here. See them coming, coming, those who have gone afore, clothed for work, in majesty divine, a congregation beyond, never changed, yet always changed, like the sea beneath the sun. Lift up your hearts. The words rumble as they've always done, louder than the lorries of progress, to the upturned arc roof and onwards, to the rapture of spring in the morning, winter of war in the evening, to a pal and a pipe and a garden in the land of the kingdom come. To those who have known mud and blood and smell, one golden dawn, the splendour of one star, the largest and the least of things. This little place, filled with a triplet of Ledbury light, stills the holy amongst the hurly-burly. Lord Jesus, have mercy, scribed in medieval tiles of sunbursts and petals, lies underfoot. Latin lettering withstood. Looking back and forwards, vow that human life is good. My second poem concerns the 16th century painted room. Now, I'm sorry we actually can't go into the building, but you can only have 15 people in there at a time, so it was a bit impossible. But what I would urge you to do is to go there with this book and read the poem when you're there and see the things that I saw and look at the things and find the details that I put in this poem. But for those of you that don't know the painted room, it's basically just on the corner of Church Street, just over there. We'll go past it when, on our way up to the church. Not much is known of the heritage of this building. It could have been a Booth Hall or a town council. It could have been a court of pie powder, where punishments were meted out to vagrants and troublemakers. It was called a court of pie powder because of the dust on the feet of people coming to Ledbury for market days and fairs, hence the powder on the dusty feet. It's likely that the town constable lived there, at the time called Sergeant Richard Skull, which I thought was brilliant, but I couldn't get it to fit in the poem, which is a bit annoying. But I thought, what an excellent name. And he was married to a woman called Elizabeth Skinner. There we are. And she is actually commemorated in the church. We'll see that later. So they kind of were perhaps merchant gentry, the emerging middle class. And what happened with the paintings is that renovation work took place there in the building in the 1980s. And as the builders were stripping it away, the plaster and wallpaper and all this kind of thing, they discovered these amazing paintings underneath, dating from the 1560s, from the Elizabethan era. And the reason why they're there is because in grand houses of the rich and wealthy, they would have tapestry hangings, actual hangings. But if you couldn't afford that, then the next best thing you can do is get some artists in and paint it on the walls. And that's exactly what they did. And so the paintings that you have in this room are kind of to show that we would like to have tapestries, but we can't afford it, so we're going to have this instead, and that's still good enough. They show paintings of not gardens. So very sort of gardens with sort of very intricate sort of geometric designs, where you would have flowers planted in each sort of square or space. And the idea with a knot garden is that you look at it from above, so you have all that wonderful pattern of that knot garden. So that's the references there to that. Just one of the references in the poem is that I make a reference to the walls being taper burnt. Back then people were extremely superstitious. So when that building was built, there are marks all over it to keep witches away. And what happened is that the carpenters would use a taper and burn, literally scorch marks into the timber beams to keep witches and spirits and the devil away. There are biblical references also in the paintings. And I'll just say about the nature of this poem is that this is the one that I said in my introduction, that I personified. So it's actually the building is speaking. A few words about Isaac Rosenberg. He was born in Bristol in 1890. He was a gifted art student. He showed a natural aptitude for art at a very early age. So he was educated in the London's East End, and then he went to the Slade School of Art, where he shone. I put here, though unfit for military service, he wasn't physically unfit. He just could not have been a soldier. For somebody, you would never imagine him being a soldier. He was very short, he was forgetful, acutely absent-minded, dreamy, slow in movement, and had a very relaxed way about him. Not something that would make a soldier. He was killed in action on the 1st of April in 1918, and what is just tragic is that he became one of the disparu, which is known as the disappeared. He quite literally went out with his platoon on a night sort of sortie and was killed. He just never came back, and his body has never been found. He has a grave to him. There is a stone to him in France, but his body isn't there. And he was 27 years old when he disappeared. So here we have, this is the poem, The 16th Century Painted Room, by me and Isaac Rosenberg. My official address is number 1 Church Street, where cobbles follow the way of the lane. My tree-ringed timbers date me to 1510. I forget my heritage, a possible Booth Hall, town council, court of pie powder with pig and poke punishments for dusty-footed vagrants. It all sounds plausible, even to me. But my walls talk of another story, with dutiful words from reverent sources.
Better is a dinner with green herbs where love is than a fat ox and hatred therewith. Come in, friends, and behold my Ledbury fame. Read my great treasure with all England in your breath. Decor uncovered, discovered, restored, and won back to the world again. My room will hold you hiddenly, in a pristine bloom of Tudor colour, charcoal black, like a girl's dark hair, ancient crimson and yellow ochre, blood red lead, artificial copper blue, the sleeping green between hues of history, earth's pigments blended with boiled glue of hoof, bone, horn, old alchemy of painted art. No witch's brew, I'm safe from devil harm. My bones are taper burnt, scratched with eight petal charms. I am a paradise. Look how fruits, lain under layers, ripen in my fresco garden. This summer land of Elizabethan outdoors interweaves, overtwines, crisscrosses into stylized designs, geometric knots of paths and hedges along my wattle and daub infills, lime and hair plaster. I felt the brushes stroke every flower open. White roses for joy, pinks for poverty, daisy humility. No flash photography, simply skill undimmed. Radiance revived. I will light with smiles the place we dream we walk alive. Thank you. We're now heading off to the market house. Thank you. So, Ledbury Market House. Let me begin here. So, there are plenty of sort of notices down below in the actual market house area. The one I chose for the book is Market House High Street, built after 1617 as Market Hall. Corn storage chambers added some 50 years later. When corn came to be sold by sample, these rooms were let. Proceeds provided coats and gowns for the poor. Butter and poultry market continued below. This is another personified poem. I've written this poem as if this building will speak. Just as a sort of potted history of the place. It started life in 1617, but it wasn't finished until years later, and it was built as a storehouse. It's on the stilts to keep the corn up from mice and rats, so that's why. And a fascinating little detail, when you go back downstairs again, if you look at the pegs, the legs, they're not just straight down. They've got a little sort of bits here. And that's to make it difficult for mice to climb up, because they'll bang their heads on the top. So that's why it's not just a straight down pillar, because they just climb up. Okay, so the high street, just outside here in the high street, there was a row of buildings known as Shop Row or Butcher Row. And that was cleared of houses, and that's when the market house started to be built. A chap called John Phillips bought this land for £40, but the money ran out, which is why it took so long to build this building. So funds that were left for the poor were used for this place instead. The idea being that when the rooms in here were let, that money would then be paid back to the poor. Kind of worked. Market days back then were very different. We still have market days, as you know, in Ledbury here. But back in those days, they're quite brutal. I mean, you've got animals out there, you've got slaughtering going on, you've got noise, it's a very dirty affair, lots of animals and birds. Not the kind of sort of things we have now, which is tables with sort of lamps and pottery and this kind of thing on it. Another reference I make in the poem is to turnpikes. Tolls that were set up on roads leading into Ledbury. And as you'll see, over here, there are signs here for public meetings for people who are angry about these turnpikes. There was a lot of disturbance from people about this because they didn't want to pay, basically, to come into Ledbury. They couldn't afford it.
So the traders hated them. Moving on in history, as I said, it's very potted, but obviously if you've got any questions, then please ask at the end or speak to Celia. What?
Sorry, I was saying, if you want to ask questions at the end, talk to Celia.
Yes, exactly what I was going to say, talk to Celia. Yes, absolutely. Another interesting thing about this building is that in 2006, the whole thing was lifted. What you're in now was lifted up knee height by hydraulics. So that, in fact, pictures are there on the screens there behind me of this. So that essentially infestation could be treated in the legs of this building. It's just quite phenomenal. This place is still in use today. I wanted to personify it because this is a place that is, I mean, it just speaks of Ledbury. It's on all the, every single piece of information about Ledbury features this place because it's an iconic building. It's right here, right in the middle, and it's black and white, and it's on pillars, and it still works, and people still use it. As I said, the poet that I used for this was Edward Thomas, quite simply because the guide at the time, Anna Stenning, brought me up here, we were talking about it, and she happened to say that she'd done a PhD in Edward Thomas. And I thought, yeah. And actually, he was the right poet to use for this. He, just looking at his biography here, he was born in London in 1878. He was a friend of Robert Frost, an American poet, who encouraged Edward Thomas to write poetry. He became one of the group known as the Dymock Poets. Basically, a group of poets walking, talking, reading, writing, and inspiring each other in a place called Dymock, near to Ledbury. His poetry mainly concerned the English countryside, weather, the seasons. He was a shy man, self-effacing man, and he suffered from depression and came close to suicide. He died at the Battle of Arras in 1917. It's interesting, Edward Thomas was old for combat. He was nearly 40 when he died. He was under no pressure to enlist. But when the writer Eleanor Fargen, who knew the Dymock poets, she asked him what it was he was fighting for, he literally bent down, he picked up a pinch of earth, and he replied, literally, for this. The last words in his war diary before he died were, roads shining like river uphill after rain. So here we have the poem for the Ledbury Market House, which features words and phrases from poems by Edward Thomas. 16 oaken legs peg me to the ground. My market town pours around, through and through, under, below, free flow. I'm still and stiff. Centred, elephantine, you will never forget me. I'm the picture postcard of Ledbury. Zigzagged black, white brick between, I formed my time frame after 1617 when I rose slow from the rumours of Shop Row. £40 birthed me at the corner end. Money well and truly spent, so the talk began. But later legacies, meant for coats and gowns for the poor of the town, dressed me instead. A great treasure house for corn storage. Arise, arise, load-bearing building. Now I pose plainly, in sight of a clear eye, vital to folk but remote, as if in history. For it would have been another world that raised me, with trading days and fairs, horses and voices through the wild air, livestock from many a road and track, until turnpikes took their toll. Then traffic, too sharp, too rude for my strong soul. I may stand above vermin, but I have borne the harm of woodworm, dry rot, boring wasps. I carry the markers of repair. I am the house that hydraulics hovered knee high in the air to treat my infested feet. Prop me up, Ledbury. I am the forefront of your town's backdrop. The chamber at my polished heart still beats to theatre, meetings, lectures, craft fairs. Climb up. My staircase is an easy tree. My olden beams breathe. Open your eyes to the air of the forest that made me. I'm going to read the poem for the Butcher Row House Museum here. We will pass it on the way up to the church, but again, it's simply too small for us all to be there. So please do take this book, go there and visit it with this book. So the little plaque beside it is actually situated on the front of the house. Butcher Row House, 16th century, originally part of a row running down the middle of High Street that was demolished circa 1830. The building was re-erected then in a backyard in High Street and moved to this site in 1979 with the Ledbury and District Society. Now, this is quite interesting and quite phenomenal about this building. It was there. Literally, you can just... Right there in the High Street, there would have been a row of houses. And they would have been right in front of the almshouses that you can see through the windows now, and they were separated by a narrow alley. They were noisy, dirty. I mean, there was blood in the streets. They stank. It was just vile. So there was a move to remove this row of shops. Now, the traders didn't like this. Obviously, they're going to lose their livelihood, and it took two acts of Parliament to actually demolish the buildings there. That was in 1835 and 1836. But the Butcher Row House Museum was dismantled and was then put just up the road there where the Shaw House charity is. It was put re-erected in their garden. And it was put there as a store. And it was a store actually for a chemist. Meacham's Chemist was the business that actually was situated at number 14 High Street. It's quite interesting because I live at number 12. And so I thought, that's very good. What happened then is that it was moved again. So it was dismantled. It took about 6 months to do that, to dismantle it, and then it was re-erected up Church Lane, and we'll go past it. That was the second move. It opened as a museum in 1981, and it makes special reference to the instruments in it, the musical instruments, and it's quite staggering what they have in there. Really, really amazing. Also, a lovely collection of chairs by a chap called Clissett. Clissett chairs are very popular, very famous. They're very simple chairs in structure and design. And Clissett was still making his chairs well into his 90s. There's a lovely picture of him in his workshop, surrounded by stuff with a chair, and him sitting there with a big white moustache and just sort of sitting there, actually in the clothes of work, as Woodbine Willie said, clothed in the divine in his clothes of work. It's also got a boot bath there, which is quite literally a bath shaped like a boot. And it was taken around houses in Ledbury for the poor to basically bath in it. Then there's a tap there, so water was taken out, you fill it up again, and then somebody else would get into it, and then it was trundled along to the next house and the next house. You can't actually get into it now. It's a bit too fragile. And also another fascinating thing there is the Ledbury lute. That's a beautiful, beautiful instrument, and I've heard that played a couple of years ago. It's going to be played again, I believe. But it's just a beautifully decorated, looped, stringed instrument. So the poet that seemed absolutely right for the Butcher Row House Museum was Ivor Gurney, being a composer himself. He was born in Gloucester in 1890. And he, like Isaac Rosenberg, showed a talent at an early age. He showed a remarkable talent for music. He won a place in the Gloucester Cathedral Choir in 1900, and he went to the Royal College of Music. He was initially turned down as a soldier because of his poor eyesight, but eventually he saw active service. He was invalided home after being gassed during the Passchendaele Offensive in 1917. It says in my bio, after the war he resumed his music studies. He was actually, in 1922, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and he was committed to mental hospitals and asylums, where, unless I find just awful. He was terrified by the electric shock treatment that he was given in these places. He continued to write poetry and compose almost up to his death, and sometimes he would still believe that he was still taking part in the war when he composed his music and wrote his poetry. So now he's with me in the Butcher Row House Museum. Small town, small museum, hums this little building, transplanted in a true Elizabethan garden, a trove of knick-knacks and bric-a-brac, costumes and curio, objects and artefacts, the ephemera of lives resonating. They must know we are. Our one-up, one-down house once owned a place in the highway of the High Street, Butcher Row, a prime-cut site for working on the hoof, buying, killing, selling, gutters flooded with blood, thick set with noisome smell, the labour sweat of custom. Complaints, acts of parliament, demolitions cleared the pinch point, except this remnant, whose daily being served a breeches maker, saddler, hairdresser. Unpegged instead, moved beam by beam to Meacham's chemist at High Street number 14, a backyard store, even for kerosene, before another flat pack move took it to Church Lane, cobbled and bloomed, the most pictured street in town. Home now to a crowded tenderness of history's tangle, with an overstock of christening gowns and cannonballs, a folk collection, songful of thronged presences, Ballard bricks, Clissett's honest chairs, letters to Mr. Scattergood. Sir, the horse you have sold me has turned out very badly. Miss Philpott's silk dress, Absalom Johnson, Bartholomew Green, the good-looking Willie Pritchett, names that sing Think on Me Too, Ledbury's Pastoral, from the boot bath washing the poor from door to door to the almost unnoticed detail of a modest casement window. Feel tiny songs stir tremblingly from enclosed instruments. Fife, balafone, hurdy-gurdy, the Ledbury lute in its purpose-built cabinet. Memoried compositions in a small museum, small town, eternally set. Thank you. I will just say that if you do pop into the Butcher Row House Museum, the letters are fascinating. I've only quoted one line. The chap goes on about the horse that Mr. Scattergood sold him. So do check that out when you go there. Right, we're now heading up Church Lane towards St. Michael's Church for tea and cake.
Can I just say, this afternoon, there is a poet in the
bar. So we're here in the church. On your way, the way up here, you would have passed the Butcher Row House Museum. You would have passed some A-boards telling you where the 16th century painted room is, and you would have passed the Heritage Centre on your left, which is now housed in the old grammar school. So I'm going to start with that poem, and then I'll finish with the poem for here. The building has been tree-ring dated to about 1489 to 1490, and as I just work through my poem, just to explain some things that might not be obvious to people that don't live here, I make reference to in verse 4 about using oak in the green. The idea being that the oak beams of the Heritage Centre were used in the green, i.e. early on in their life, so they're easy to bend. Otherwise, oak, it's a hard wood. It's very difficult to work it. But if it's actually cut down when it's young, then you can bend it around and you can do things with it. The style of the upper floor windows, if you go back again with this book, show an East Anglian influence. And some of the Bressmer beam mouldings and whatever. And then I've got Herefordshire's down-to-earthiness, because the East Anglians liked a little bit of, flourish, a little bit of we'll just sort of decorate this up. Herefordian things were very simple. Right, that's it. It's a window. We're making it a window. So that's kind of the difference between the different architectural structures. It was kind of, may have been built for the wool trade in Ledbury, which is a reference I make in the poem. There's a stream that runs underneath. In fact, the stream starts here. It runs down and it ran through the Heritage Centre. So the idea being that perhaps wool fleeces were washed in that stream. If you go into the Heritage Centre, there's like a sort of a hole in the ground, which is sort of covered over with glass or whatever, or see-through perspex or something. And you can actually stand and see where that stream used to flow. Lead tokens were found during renovation, which could have perhaps been coinage, and I make a reference to that. And then it became the town's grammar school. It was called the King Edward VI Grammar School, after Edward VI, who reigned from 1547 to 53. So that gives you the idea of when that became a school. And I remember when I took the school children from Ledbury Primary School there, they were just amazed. Lessons were in Latin, harsh conditions, boys, no girls. And I remember a little girl saying to me, "Well, what did the girls do then?" And I said, "Well, they stayed at home and learnt how to cook and sew things." So she wasn't too happy about that. But they would go there at the age of 7 or 8 and stay there until their teens. They would stand up or sit on very hard benches for hours at a time, long periods of time. I mean, the pain of that must have been just awful, just to sit on these hard benches. The lessons were in Latin, as I said, and they had to be learned by heart. And there was punishments given out if you didn't. In there, quite fascinatingly, is some glass squares that were found with renovation work, where some boys had scratched their names into the glass. And you can still make out the one that I have in my poem, Thomas Bridge. It says, "Thomas Bridge, 1772. This little boy had done that, and that still survives now. So it became the Heritage Centre in 1978. I haven't, in the poem, focused too much on the Heritage Centre. I focused on it being the old grammar school. So my poem takes that in. And the poets I chose to work with for this one were women writers, women war poets. Very little is known about them. I have found out information about all of them, save one. Lesbia Thanet was an American poet, that's all I know, and that her poem In Time of War, which I used in the book, was published in an anthology called War Verse. I can't find any photograph of her, I can't find anything else other than that. But the others, I have found interesting things about. I think I used about 6 or 7 women. Sorry, more than that. Actually, looking at this, about 8 or 9 women in this poem. Some names maybe you may know, like Charlotte Mew. I used her in the poem. It was her poetry, Charlotte's poetry, that established her literary reputation. But she entered a nursing home in London. She committed suicide in 1928. I've got Edith Nesbit. Now, we know Edith E. Nesbit from her children's literature. And yet, she wrote war poetry. She wrote poetry at the time of the war. A lot of the women had relatives, sons, husbands in the war at the time. And so they wrote their poems based on the feelings of absence and goodbye and the hope and longing that they would come back. Right, so I'm going to read this poem now. This is the Heritage Centre at the Old Grammar School. This faded black and white pen and ink building has learnt the lessons of the town, seen changes, made connections, passed on teaching in its timbers, from the top of the yawning Smoke Bay chimney to the red sandstone, clayed oyster shells beneath. Study the old ways of construction, wattle and daub, peg and joint structures, moulded bressimers, lines of queen post roof trusses, carpenter's marks, the jigsaw expression of East Anglian influences, Herefordshire's down to earthiness, traditions high. Come by,
Wool merchants flock. The trade knits into the shuttling spin of business. Long-haired fleeces for worsted cloth. Lead tokens, yarn swapped and sold. Washing wool clean of sheep in the underwater course. But let's linger in a later time at the old grammar school. In that still quietness, where is space for thought? Can you see them? Hear them? There they go. Mother's sons, all knees and knuckles, still at play, still in the green, like the unseasoned oak beams holding up the elderly building. Young enough to bend their place in the world, scratch names in glass. Thomas Bridge in 1772, we know you. There's one who means to show his grit, one who'd rather wait a bit, and one who'll stand and bite his thumbs. Go forth, boys. Seek adventure in some other place. Chant your Latin. Diligently correct every error. Apply the movements of arm, hand, fingers, and let your pens bear witness to your successes. Hold your heads high under the low beams. A painful lesson for us taller future folk. We will story it and glory it and share it all. Hard survivals, where life knows death and soldiers on. Stoicism, so commonplace, so dear, little brothers. Legacies left in leaflets, wisdom schooled by the past. Your time out of mind, better learned by heart. Sorry, overrunning slightly. I don't know what the score is yet on the football. But okay, so now finally we come to the last poem. And this is St. Michael and All Angels, Ledbury Parish Church. The Domesday Book of 1086 mentions a large and important Minster church here, but no trace of it remains. So the earliest parts of this building date from the 12th century. And as I mentioned before, a stream runs beneath the church, so it may show signs of perhaps past pagan worship. There's a mechanical carillon that happens here. So we have a separate bell tower, and that's interesting. It's one of seven in the county, so it's separate to this building which houses the bells. But there is a mechanical tune that rings out at 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock every day. These memorial slabs or ledger stones on the ground show professions of people that lived in Ledbury. So at the end there we have the town baker. Somewhere over here we have a pin maker, and I make reference to those in the poems. Now, the church has seen many changes and restorations over the centuries. I make reference to the movement of time, pagan, Norman, Gothic to Victorian. Also, other fascinating little details that I didn't know when I first came in here. But if you look at some of the stained glass, just in the bottom corner, you may see on some of it a little wheat sheaf. And the wheat sheaf was a trademark of Charles E. Kemp, who was a stained glass artist. And I've seen stained glass in other churches. Now I know what I'm looking for. See those little wheat sheaves. The crystal cross, which is here, behind me, up here, that was made in the 1960s as a means of lighting. So sort of catching the light and then lighting up that chancel. Just behind you over there, in the window as you come in through the door, is a sundial window. That's very rare. It probably dates from about the early 18th century, but the window itself is mid-13th century. It's kind of Herefordshire geometric design. But that's very rare, and I love that. There's a sundial just there that you wouldn't ordinarily notice when you first come in. I chose Rupert Brooke as the poet for this one. Basically because I wanted to write a sonnet for the church, and I knew that he had written a series of sonnets entitled 1914. The way I wrote this poem is that all the words are mine, except for
the last word on every line. And the last word is taken from Sonnets by Rupert Brooke. Now, Rupert Brooke was, he went to Cambridge University. Let me find him on my, here we are, yes. He was born in Rugby in 1887. He went to Cambridge University where he had a brilliant undergraduate career. And he travelled widely before the war. Like Wilfred Owen, he went off to the war happy. He was almost anxious to die for his country in battle. He was completely suffused with patriotism. He really was. He died of, he basically died of an insect bite on his way to Gallipoli. His death, it was just terrible. It was just such a chance thing to have happened. At his burial, he was buried on the Greek island of Skyros, and at his burial, he was surrounded by his friends. Four of his closest friends buried Brooke on top of a high hill on the island. And what's amazing, there was a long procession, and it was led by a sailor carrying an enormous white cross with Brooke's name written on it in black. And the procession took 2 hours to get to the top of the hill for the ceremony. So the last post was sounded. The grave was marked literally by slabs of marble that were lying about. They just pretty much almost just chucked it on there. And then there was the long march back down the hill, sort of a lamp-lit march back. So, this is the final poem. St. Michael and All Angels, Ledbury Parish Church, written by me and Rupert Brooke. Built in the easterly print of another, every third hour this Minster church sings a daytime hymn to the sleeping and living town, a mechanical carolling. But real glory power comes in ringing, the hand-pulled peals of bells are leaping, echoing over and under floor memorials of the once known. Bricklayer, ironmonger, pinmaker, plumber, now friended in death. Pagan, Norman, Gothic to Victorian, patterns alone set in stone chevrons, wheat sheaf motifs, in labours ended, remembrances begun. Knees and feet rub ledger letters old, lives chronicled in marble monuments, rainbow glass given us to have and hold. The organ heralds, voices pipe exalted gold, swelling space with depth. Sense the sacred in your own heaven. Light reflects the crystal cross. Alike shines on your most blessed. The sundial window shadows when in peace we all shall rest. There will be, this event will be repeated, because there was actually a long waiting list for this event. So we've decided to do a winter walk, hopefully on the 13th of November at night. So we'll be exactly the same route. We'll be meeting at the Master's House with hopefully mulled wine, blankets, and we will visit the buildings at night when they are candlelit. And we'll come back here and we'll have soup. So look out for the posters and notices for that later on in the year.